Rabbi David Saperstein was the U.S. Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom during the final 2 years of the Obama administration. Prior to that important position, David led the Union for Reformed Judaism's Religious Action Center for over 30 years. For many years, he has also been an active member of Interfaith Alliance and its board of directors. Now back at the RAC in the role of senior advisor, David Saperstein brings a breadth and depth of knowledge that few other people have. And I'm very happy to be able to welcome him to State of Belief. David, it's great to see you.
Always a pleasure to talk with you, Walton.
You had a unique position from which to view religious liberty issues around the globe. As you look back, would you say the general trend in relation to religious freedom is more positive or is it more negative?
It's inconsistent. The Pew research arm does a calculation and evaluation of what the trends are year after year. So using consistent patterns is able to give us some insight into this. The good news is about 75% of the countries in the world do not have any kind of serious restrictions on religious freedom or societal hostilities that interfere with religious communities' ability to live their lives openly and freely. The bad news is that amongst the countries that have either social hostilities or government infringement on religious freedom are included some of the most populous countries in the world. China, obviously, would fit into that. Nigeria and Egypt and Pakistan. India has societal issues, et cetera. So there are the numbers of people, they say about 75% of the world's population lives in countries that have serious restrictions on religious freedom. In some countries, things are getting better. In some countries, they are getting worse. And there's clear reasons for the pattern of where they are getting worse, and that is a central challenge for us to address those underlying sources of the deterioration.
David, what is the role of American diplomacy in advancing religious freedom?
The United States, first of all, is a driving force on this issue. In part, it has to do with our history, that religious freedom was a founding principle of America. In our Constitution's ban on religious tests for office, its promise of free exercise of religion, and its bar against any law even respecting a government establishment of religion, a revolutionary concept was implemented for the first time in human history. For America was the first country that promised that your rights as a citizen would not depend upon your religious identity, your religious beliefs, your religious practices. And like many of our promised rights, it took us a long time to get there. Yeah. But by the middle of the 20th century, the 1930s, 40s, 50s, the Supreme Court was coming down with a range of strong court decisions that really made this possible. And we saw groups like Jews, who often have been subject to quotas in universities, in businesses, barred from country clubs, here move from the peripheries of American society to the very center of American societies. The Supreme Court, and then backed by Congress, asserted the rights of women and the rights of minorities, including Catholics and Jews and agnostics and disabled and dissenters, to participate fully and equally in American society. And we're not there yet, but on the level of religious freedom, it really has been an extraordinary revolution on this idea. And the ideas while this was happening was exactly the period that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights were being drafted. And America's vision of these ideas infused much of the powerful human rights values and ideals that were implemented in those treaties. So America's played an important role. I was very encouraged that we were able to continue during the time of my tenure in working with the Canadian government. There was an ambassador for religious freedom. We shaped an international contact group of over 30 countries working together to make a priority of fighting for religious freedom. And there is a similar coalition of about 65 caucuses and parliaments. We're talking in both these groups. There are countries with majority religions of every major religion in the world, different continents, very diverse groups. We share in common this belief that people should be able to live freely and safely, alone and in community with those who share their beliefs on the core issues of conscience that religious freedom protects.
I'd like for you to talk about one particular place in the world where U.S. participation had a positive impact.
You know, there are a range of things that one could cite. There are interfaith efforts that many people don't know. It's not just the diplomacy. And what is known somewhat for everyone who follows the field and the general public is the fact that there is built into the international religious freedom structure our designation every year of countries of particular concern against whom economic sanctions can be imposed. The sanctions against Iran, they weren't affected by the nuclear deal, and they remain in place here. And there are sanctions on a number of countries as well. What people don't know that much about is we also invest the United States government significantly in programmatic activity that is aimed at building an infrastructure of religious freedom and tolerance and understanding and pluralism, interfaith cooperation, as it does more broadly on human rights. So in the time that I was there, both the secretary and the leadership of the State Department and the administration, but also the Congress, was extraordinarily supportive of our efforts. My budget doubled. My staff doubled. The program money increased fivefold from $3.5 million to $20 million. And we use those monies to support interfaith efforts like those that helped tamp down the violence in Burma when it exploded a few years ago in Mictila and in Mandalay, or in the Central African Republic a year later. And a remarkable interfaith coalition at Time Magazine held up as the group of them, though among the 100 most important people in the world because they helped tamp down the ethnic and religious violence at the time. I was in the courtroom in Khartoum when two of the most prominent religious prisoners were released by a court, as a court had released Miriam Ibrahim, who was accused of blasphemy just a year before I came on, because many of us have been advocating on her behalf. Many of the activists credit the United States' engagement on this issue and our presence in the country on this issue as one factor that contributes to that. And if I had to lift up anything, I think that the government of Vietnam deserves a lot of credit for rewriting their own law on religious freedom. They didn't have actually a law. It's the first time they wrote it. And engaging with their own religious communities in several drafts of the law and with the international community and really listened and absorbed and adopted many of the recommendations that the international community brought to bear, and the U.S. played a leadership role in this. They still have very serious problems that exist, but this was a major improvement that will make life better for millions of people and allow us now and Vietnam not only to applaud what has been good in what they've achieved, but to focus on the outstanding issues of deconcern that we continue to hope there will be more improvement on.
So, David, what happens now? And I say that in such a somber way because during the presidential election campaigns, we saw evidence that there was a lot of weak understanding about religious freedom, and then some direct blows to religious freedom that would be breaking our constitutional commitments. So what happens now?
First, on the international level, I remain, even though in these initial couple of months, there have been indications that the administration may not be as vigorous on the human rights front in general, as prior Republican and Democratic administrations have been. Yeah. And I think that would be a setback for United States interests and United States values, should that turn out to be true, but it remains to be seen. But what I do believe is that international religious freedom enjoys such staunch support from Democrats and Republicans, from the left and the right, from liberals and moderates and conservatives, wall-to-wall support that the Religious Freedom Office will remain a robust office. An ambassador at large will be appointed to succeed me. And I suspect and hope that it will be somebody of significance. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, there's an extraordinary staff in the office there, and they continue to further America's interests and values every day mm-hmm. in the ongoing work they do with countries all across the world yeah. on behalf of religious freedom.
Obviously, you were still in that office after Election Day, and you were carrying on the kind of great work that you'd been doing. Did you sense any fear in the international community about what was going to happen?
Throughout 2016, as I traveled across the globe and would talk to government officials and civil society leaders about America's concerns about the plight, almost always, of religious minorities. Infringements on religious freedom happen either because the government is secular and constrains religion in general, or the government is comprised primarily of one religious group and minority groups tend to suffer, or where there are authoritarian regimes in general and who are frightened by people's ability or willingness or commitment to organizing their lives around principles, religious ideas and practices mm-hmm. and customs in a peaceful way that nonetheless the government may not be able to fully control. All of those reasons exist. And wherever I went, I would talk about how minorities were being treated. I would hear repeatedly throughout 2016, well, what about your own country? Isn't it hypocritical to criticize us when Muslims are being mistreated in the United States mm-hmm. And the hate crimes have risen mm-hmm. And the president-elect is talking about a ban on Muslims? What's the difference? And this wasn't just me. This was ambassadors throughout the country. It was our extraordinary United States representatives to the Muslim world and to the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. Mm-hmm. Our people who did that were just great. And we would all bring the same message. Every country has problems. But if you look at the United States, the number of hate crimes as a proportion of our population compared to other countries facing similar challenges is very small. A much higher percentage of them are just rhetorical or things written on buildings, comparatively few physical attacks on people, and actual destruction of property. Every one of those that does happen are terrible. The fact that we are smaller in number does not mean we shouldn't respond to every single one of them. And that is what our country does. When these things happen, the political leadership of the country comes out and condemns it. The religious leadership and its strong interfaith coalitions that exist in almost every city. And Welton, you deserve a lot of credit for being inspiration, not just in what you achieved in Interfaith Alliance, building it, and Jack Moline carries on today, but inspiring many other communities around the country. Mm. And you and I went and spoke yeah. to some of those communities together, and yeah. it was extraordinary what goes on. Yeah. And so something, an attack on synagogues, Muslims and Christians come out, and yeah. Baha'is and Buddhists and Hindus to clean up graffiti, yeah. to stand in solidarity, to repair damage. And when a mosque is attacked, the synagogues and churches offer their buildings where mosques have been damaged. This is an extraordinary country in its strong interfaith commitment, the pluralism, the respect that goes on, the fact that these are an anomaly out of the 330 million Americans, you know, to have less than 1,000 hate crimes, most of them not physical right. violence against any one group. It's terrible. It happens. Everyone is terrible. Mm-hmm. But it has to be seen with some perspective. And I think in the main that most people we spoke to understood at the end of those explanations of mm-hmm. lifting up the reality of America, that America still remains a shining example of religious pluralism and respect and cooperation. We are, after all, the most religiously diverse country in the history of the human race. Yeah. Sociologists tell us that 2,000 religions and sects and denominations, many of them very small and some mm-hmm. strange to others, and yet there is enormous tolerance and respect for religion, for religious leaders, for religious organizations, and between religious groups in this remarkable country.
We've seen a shocking rise in anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. Is this at all tied to the rhetoric of the past election?
Polling data has indicated that there are millions of people in the United States who hold racist, anti-Semitic, anti-Muslim views. The number of people has fallen since the end of World War II through the 1990s, in part because of the rise of education. Mm-hmm. And we all know exceptions that exist on college campuses, on particularly politicized racism and anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. But in the main, the higher your level of education, the less likely you are to hold racist, anti-Semitic, anti-Muslim attitudes. That has been an extraordinary advance. But there are still tens of millions who hold those views, a shrinking number, a shrinking percentage, but there's still tens of – the extraordinary thing about America was the cultural and social constraints against expressing that. It was relegated to the fringes of American society. This was an extraordinary period from the end of World War II until recent days in this regard. Mm-hmm. And again, the fact that – we talk about an increase of 60% in hate crimes of Muslims, but it went from, 280 to 390. Jews, that had about double that number, went from 700 and something to 900 and so. I mean, we don't know the exact number when it's sorted out what this will be. This is a bad period. Yeah. And one of the things that happened in this election campaign, the confluence of two factors. One is the anonymity of social media. It has allowed people who would have been under social and cultural constraints against voicing something openly to do it anonymously. Mm-hmm. And our social media is permeated with hate speech and prejudicial speech. And this is deeply alarming. But then in the last race, there were candidates who ran, and I include the President of the United States, who engaged in coarse rhetoric that demeaned people by the groups they were in, that demeaned people individually. He broke through a lot of the taboos. He legitimized for many people the expression of ideas and feelings that heretofore they wouldn't have done and wouldn't have acted on. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that they harbored those in their heart, we needed, and you devoted much of your life to engaging people, including those who had differing views, to try and change them through interaction and engagement and deeper understanding. We had to do that, even with people who didn't express it. But the result is that the public arena today is filled with messages that wouldn't happen have happened before. Mm-hmm. The social media is very hard to reverse. The President of the United States could do extraordinary things in helping to reverse this, to delegitimize this, to say whatever happened in the past, enough. This is not America. Yeah. This is not what we stand for. This is not what we are about. I've said this, that I'm committed to being the president of all people, and I am going to manifest and express that now. Without the president, it will be very hard to go back in the direction. We won't go back for a while, no matter what happens, but in the direction we were. But the president, more than any other single person, can make a contribution to greatly heal a number of the wounds that have been inflicted over these last year, 18 months.
When you look at these issues, the bigotry issues, you look at it from the perspective of a religious leader and as a lawyer. Mm-hmm. Does that make a difference?
Perhaps in the sense that we're always looking for ways to enhance religious freedom, and that requires legal steps. We all work together to pass the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. I think it has worked significantly to enhance religious freedom in this country. What we didn't see was that the religious freedom claims would be used to claim there is religious justification for individuals to discriminate against other protected categories in the United States. This is a serious challenge. I think the courts in general have been right where they have consistently said that protecting the civil rights claims of protected categories, women, African Americans led to national origin, Latino, Asian Americans, religious groups of all kinds, and growingly the LGBT community, that defending those religious rights is a compelling interest that can limit religious freedom claims. I think within that, there are ways to accommodate individuals who don't wish to participate or do things, so long as people are being served in a timely manner without any awkwardness or embarrassment. I think there are ways to balance these things out. I just want to say another word on it, though, Welton. I think those of us who share my view about the importance of the civil rights claims also have to recognize how sincerely so many of the people who are making religious claims feel about some of the things that they are arguing they don't want to be implicated in, they don't want to be complicit in. These are important debates to have in American society. I take every one of those them seriously, and I really am working hard with many others on all sides of the religious spectrum and political spectrum to see where there's common ground that can diffuse some of the angst over this. But I pray for the day that the kind of religious freedom claims that I had encountered across the globe, where I saw people who were being put in jail for their religious beliefs, who were being tortured, what ISIL and Boko Haram and al-Shabaab were doing in kidnapping people and raping women and forcing them to marry others and forcibly converting people, cutting off heads of believers of their own faith who disagreed with their interpretation of their own religion. When I see the brutality, the persecution, the oppression that so many millions of people do, I pray for the day when the kind of debates that we have all across the globe will be whether or not corporations have free exercise rights and how to most appropriately balance out legitimate competing claims of religious freedom and other civil rights claims. We should keep perspective and a great deal of pride about the fact that we don't have the problems that others have across the globe, and those millions and millions of people and every religion is oppressed and persecuted somewhere. They need America. They need us working together on their behalf.
Rabbi David Saperstein is Senior Advisor at Union for Reform, Judaism's Religious Action Center. He just completed his term as U.S. Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom. David, this has been so insightful. Thank you for doing it again today on State of Belief.
Well, thank you, Welton, for everything you've done throughout your career. You've made this country a better place.
Thank you, sir. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We're counting on you now more than ever, and quite frankly, so are many listeners who aren't able to find the voices that we amplify week after week anywhere else. We have to have this show on the air. If you've heard something that you found to be helpful, I urge you to share that with others who might also benefit from hearing it. It's really easy to do on Facebook and Twitter. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. That's at stateofbelief.com. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Our terrific producer is Ray Kirstein. We're in Washington, D.C. this week for the Interfaith Alliance Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards, honoring broadcaster Diane Rehm and constitutional activist Keyser Khan. Be sure to join us next week for highlights from that celebration, plus more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.